This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. So, the election is over, and for the most part, Republicans won big across the country and in Utah. But why exactly? What shaped this election? Who voted and who didn't vote? And what does that mean now, going forward? Today on this show, we're airing a forum hosted last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about who won and why. The panelists include Dan Jones, the president of Dan Jones & Associates and a former adjunct professor of political science at the University of Utah, Doug Foxley, a Republican lobbyist at the Utah State Legislature who has worked on multiple election campaigns for Republican candidates, Frank Pignanelli, also a lobbyist and a political columnist for the Deseret News and a former Utah State Legislator, and Jason Perry, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, who served as the moderator for this discussion.
This is quite the conversation we're about to have. Let's start off with kind of the big question, the title. We know who won, but let's talk about it, because we all chatted the night of the election, and as we're having the early returns, this ended up being one that no one predicted. Although I should say, for everyone, Dan Jones, our pollster, had every single race in Utah right.
He did.
Every single one of them. Okay, you can comment on that later. But let's chat for a second, because many people, including most of the pollsters all around the country, really had Hillary Clinton, at least 70% likelihood. They all got it wrong. What happened? How did Donald Trump pull this off? Doug, let's start with you.
Well, first of all, Jason, thanks for being here. How about those Utes last night? I mean, let's talk about something, you know, everybody kind of agrees on. And, you know, I tell you, if I'd known coming into the Pac-12 was going to give us the Southern California weather, I think we should have gone into the Pac-12 years ago. Jason, why didn't you pull that off?
I agree with that. Well, sorry, we didn't work until later.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating topic, but let me just tell you a few things. Number one is, you know, the sun did come up. The world continues to revolve upon its axis. But really, I think actually democracy is better off today with what happened. And I'll tell you why I think that. There's some good news that came out of this election. Number one, the Bush dynasty is dead. Number two, the Clinton dynasty is dead. For the good of the republic, I think we're all better off. As to Hillary Clinton should have been elected president of the United States. She will try to blame everyone in the world, but she has no one to blame herself. Now, Frank and I read a great book, and I think you guys, many of you may have read it, called Hillbillyology, but it really talks about a certain segment of people who were left behind in what has happened in our ever-changing world. And that is primarily a whole bunch of blue-collar, former union, manufacturing individuals who live in the states that all of a sudden turned around and all of a sudden gave a majority of votes and hence the electoral win to Donald Trump. Who would have thought that Wisconsin would have voted for Donald Trump? Who would have thought Michigan would have voted for Donald Trump? Every 4 years, every election cycle, the Republicans always put tons of money, tons of resources into Pennsylvania. Guess what? Pennsylvania went for Donald Trump. Ohio, you know, a state the Republicans had of it, it went early. It was called early. Now, you know, Dan and others can, and Frank and you can get into this, but to me, I think it was late voters obviously broke for Donald Trump. Also, you had a suppression of the vote. You, the young, the millennials, you did not vote like you voted in the past. And also, a large number of minority groups, in particular blacks, did not vote. Also, Donald Trump, he basically received more votes in the Latino, Hispanic community than Mitt Romney did. He also did with blacks. So it's a strange anomaly. I think people talk about, you know, basically, if you talk to Charlie Cook or any of the political prognosticators about really the dying presidential model of the Republican Party, which it's basically based on, you know, aging white males. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, the aging white males and others came back and said, we don't like what's going on. We don't like either choice. But guess what? You know, to us, we need to do something different. Hence, in the end, I think the late deciders went for Donald Trump, and hence he carried the upper Midwest states, and we had a surprise that nobody anticipated.
Dan, how did all those national pollsters get it wrong?
Well, polling has changed so much from 1928 when George Gallup did it, the first real major poll. And in the state of Iowa, and he got it right. But in 1936, pollsters relied on magazine subscriptions to the Literary Digest and automobile registrations. Well, they had the wrong sample. In 1948, they got their ears pinned back when they predicted that Harry Truman was going to get defeated. And he didn't give up and awakened after California voted to find out he had won. Well, that was a major surprise. I remember my parents saying about Harry Truman winning in 1948. And he had a really tough administration. He did. Well, then after, Gallup and the guys got together and they did a real probability sample. And everyone who was a likely voter had an equal opportunity to be an interview. Well, this election wasn't about likely voters. I had to use a blended sample. I used some telephone numbers that were from individuals who had voted in the past. I used some individuals who had cell phones. I did a group of, I sent out postcards and said, are you interested in participating? And then they mailed them back to us. And then we would call them and interview them and keep going back to them. And so we did it fine in Utah, but that wouldn't have worked nationally. They've got to go back to the drawing board. Larry Sabato, who spoke here to the Hinckley Institute, I remember it well. And became the outstanding professor in polling at the University of Virginia. And he said it this way, we got it wrong. We've got to go back to the drawing board. Now, I think it's fatalistic for the media to say that polls are over with. No, they're not. Look how much we relied on the polls in every one of the primaries, and to determine if individuals would get to be able on to be on the debate, to have to get a certain percentage. Well, they relied on polls. You can't interview everybody, but we got to find a better way of drawing samples and get a probability sample of individuals who are going to vote. And it will come about, hey, notice, Gallup didn't do it. Gallup got its ears pinned back because they announced that Romney is going to win. No, they didn't poll this year. They said it's too difficult. And so the ORC and NBC polls and so forth have really going to have to look at how polls were conducted. Now, I promise you, polling will continue in the state of Utah. And I feel very, very proud. I don't like to be called a pollster. Over the years, I've had such a terrible name. But I do like to be called a researcher. A researcher of polling data. Cephalology is the study of voting and polling.
Let's break out a couple of these things that Dan has talked
about. You know, it's tough being a pollster, but being a lawyer and a lobbyist, I mean,
yeah,
oh my
I was wondering.
Gosh. Yeah, anyway.
If you had to rank those, pollster, lobbyist.
I consider myself a government education specialist instead of a lobbyist. How's that?
It sounds better.
So Dan, I kind of remember Abraham Lincoln, but was that George Washington guy? Was he as good as everybody said he was?
Hey, don't answer any of that.
Jason, a couple things maybe can I throw out here?
Yeah, please.
I was on the phone today with one of our clients who's back in D.C. They said, you know, this was a strange election since there was a lot of involvement by Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. From the very beginning, McKay Coppins, who'll be here to Hinckley Forum in a couple weeks,
right,
who wrote the book The Wilderness, he's the one that wrote an article, a blog post, 2 years ago saying that Donald Trump didn't have the guts to run for president. And so Donald Trump wrote a letter back, so I'm going to show you. And so there's a little thing that's going through the internet saying that McKay Coppins is responsible for
so that was the moment when he just decided, okay, I'll show you.
And he has Utah connections. But if you look at all the analysis that's going on as to what happened, one of it is that the Democratic vote was lower than expected, mm-hmm, and than usual. Secondly, that there was the email scandal, and especially the Comey letter.
And that came out towards the end. Talk about how that influenced this and the timing.
I will admit it, but there's a Utah connection to that, okay?
Oh, boy.
You know, these mafioso types, you know, they always...
I cannot wait to hear this
There's
one.
Always a conspiracy somewhere, you know, but anyway.
And I write about this in a column. Every Republican candidate who had a tough fight and won should send a thank you note to Congressman Jason Chaffetz, because he's the one that started this thing and beat the hell out of the email controversy, and obviously Comey was scared of him, and so that's why he did that letter towards the very end, because it was that email controversy that led to Democrats questioning Clinton, along with other things that depressed the vote, that excited the Republicans to come out and vote, and that it was weird what the FBI director did, but I believe there's a tie in that he was nervous that there were so many leaks from the FBI that if he didn't do something, that the Jason Chaffetz, you know, Committee on Oversight was going to react. So, again, there's a Utah connection to what happened in the national election.
Well, we stayed relevant through this entire thing, didn't we?
We did, the stuff with Evan McMullen, everything like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a second about something that couldn't be captured in some of these polls that many were calling the shy Trump vote, the closet Trump vote. I don't know what you want to call it, but it's something that the polls didn't capture at all. It turns out that was much higher than everyone suspected. And you know, even as we see on campus, when pollsters were calling, if you were a supporter of Hillary Clinton, you were more likely to admit it than when pollsters were calling about Donald Trump. Let's explore that for just a minute as to why you think that hidden vote was there and why at the very end it just exploded.
I think there's something to it. Now, I poo-pooed it up until Wednesday. And the reason why I think there may be something to it is if you look at that USC poll that the LA Times was using, theirs was online. All the other polls had the personal connection. There's a belief, there's a theory that because they predicted, now granted they predicted Donald Trump would win by 6% on the national vote, but they still predicted a Trump victory, that people were more willing to admit that they were voting for Trump online because they were anonymous. Mm-hmm. It was hidden, whereas they're talking to on the phone or in person with somebody. Now, has that been statistically proven? No, but you have to give some credence that was the only survey that predicted a Trump victory, was online and was anonymous.
Dan, you gonna take that?
Yeah, but I believe that, what I found with Trump and Hillary Clinton was I've never polled for presidential candidates that had such a high negative. And the main reason they didn't like Hillary Clinton was over a 65 negative. See, to win, you're supposed to have a 3-1 positive. Well, is because they didn't trust her. And no matter what she did, they couldn't break that down. They didn't like Donald Trump because of the number of people that he insulted. And you can name them and so forth. But where I really saw in Utah where they came back to Trump is when Vice President-elect Pence came here and he tried to get the endorsement of Governor Gary Herbert. He wouldn't give it. But others did, like the Speaker of the House, Mr. Hughes. But I saw it in my polling that Mr. Trump went up 4 or 5 points because they saw Chaffetz came around, Bishop came around, Stewart, who really writes things that are holier than thou, came
like
around.
Like Mussolini?
So that's where I saw the real change. And then I knew then that Evan McMullen wouldn't win. But he did amazing things and got a lot of people in Utah involved. Wait a minute. Utah's not going to be the lowest this time. It was an over 80% turnout in Salt Lake County, and they haven't even finished counting the ballots yet. 120,000. So the total numbers, percentages, are going to change.
Dan, I'd like to talk about that for a minute. I think it's just gross incompetence. I think it's malfeasance. In this day and age, that Sherry Swenson, who has done this, who has been in this elected position, can't get it right.
No. Sherry Swenson is the finest clerk I've ever worked with.
But Dan,
you can take that to the
bank. Dan, she proposes 24 polling places.
The legislature.
No, in the county. All of a sudden, the county council made her go up to 39. I mean, you have every 2 years, you have the opportunity of getting it right. I mean, Republicans and Democrats need to get together and say, look, we've got a county recorder, a nice man, but he's non-functioning. You know, get him out. We probably ought to eliminate the office. If Sherry Swenson can't get it right, we have this debacle. Every 2 years, if she can't get it right, then, you know, let's get somebody in there that can do it right. Or let's have somebody who appointed. But Dan, we live through this. I mean, it is now Friday. You know, we're not in the horse and buggy days. We're not counting ballots by lantern, for heaven's sakes.
Well, the people could go ahead and send in the day of the election.
Oh, blame the voters.
I'm part of the problem.
Blame the voters.
Blame the voters. Let me finish. What I want to tell you is they could register up till the day of the election. We've never had that before. And you're talking about Sherry Swenson. Hey, we got 29 counties in the state. Many of them still haven't got their ballots completely counted. 20,000 of them. So, what are you going to do? Release all of them? We tried voting by mail. Now, I have a former student who's ahead of the mail voting up in Oregon and said it is a very, very tough system. You will not be able to predict the night of the election who won, because they're not all in. They get the postmark clear up to that final day. Those are the ballots that aren't in. They're coming in, they'll be in by Tuesday. Tuesday, you'll know what happened.
And that was Dan Jones, the president of Dan Jones & Associates, the professional polling agency, speaking as part of a panel recorded recently about the results of the recent election. And you're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited in their entirety as a public service to you. And today we are airing a discussion recorded recently at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about the results of the recent election. Who won and why? Also, what was Utah's role in the overall national election? How did the down-ballot races play out across this state? And who turned out to vote, who didn't, and what happens now? The panelists of the conversation included Dan Jones, the president of Dan Jones & Associates and former adjunct professor of political science at the University of Utah, Doug Foxley, a Republican lobbyist at the Utah State Legislature. He's also worked on multiple campaigns for Republican candidates. Frank Pignanelli, who's also a lobbyist. He also writes a political column for the Deseret News, and he was formerly a Utah State Legislator. And Jason Perry, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He was the moderator.
Hey, can we ask about this voter turnout for a second? Because we've seen the numbers about the people who are the likely voters, but if you look at the state of Utah in terms of the actual eligible voters that showed up, we were at 49% here in this election cycle, the third lowest in the country, which is very interesting considering everyone seems to be so interested in this. How do we explain this turnout? It may come back to your really insightful beginning, Doug, too, about one of the key things that happened in this race is the Democrats didn't show up. Talk about that firewall a little bit and who didn't show up. Doug, do you want to talk about that first?
Don't go.
Follow near court.
Well, as you know, 25, 30 years ago, we were among the highest of voter turnout.
Always, as I learned at the feet of Dan Jones, Utah, we were proudly and consistently in the top three in the country in voter turnout.
And so, in fact, there was a commission that was established by Governor Huntsman about 10 years ago to understand why we went from the top to the bottom in terms of voter turnout. There was some belief that maybe it was tied to the one-party system in the state here, but yet you have places like Alpine where they shoot Democrats on site, had the highest voter turnout. And so that wasn't matching up.
Explain it. Do you have a thought why that happened?
Shooting Democrats
on site? Not that part,
site,
yes. Well, we understand turnout. That.
I think it's a cultural thing in terms of whatever, I don't know what's happening, the schools or the families, that voting is not being appreciated as the priority of civic duty. That something's happening. I'm not going to blame the political parties for it. I'm not going to blame the politicians for it because they're doing their best to get people to go out to vote. There's something happening in our state where it's not being taught in the schools, it's not being taught in the kitchen tables to go out and vote. And that's where we need to focus our efforts instead of blaming elected officials or blaming others.
But part of it too, Frank, is the fact that, you know, as a kid, I remember going over and voting with my parents. Mm-hmm. I took my children to the voting booth to with me so that you could teach them. Now you get this very impersonal thing along with a whole bunch of junk mail. So I mean, it's not that you have this opportunity to have these teaching moments.
Well, you may be right there. I don't know what it is. But we talk about it, but we don't do anything about it. And that's the next thing I say is we need to, what I wanted to do, and unfortunately they didn't do it, when they established this Governor's Commission on Voting, I wanted to hire Dan Jones and spend a lot of money researching what the hell's going on. But they didn't do it. They wanted to make it free, and therefore what you got what you paid for was a bunch of political hacks like me talking about stuff and ended up in nothing. So I really believe that if we could hire Dan Jones, a deep survey, a deep dive into what is happening, we could create perhaps a response to turn this around. Now as to the Democratic vote was down across the country. I mean, if she had had the same votes as Obama, she would have won. But she was a flawed candidate. I mean, despite all the Trump's problems, she was a flawed candidate. In addition to the email controversy, she had a hard time connecting. I mean, she would say things like, about the coal miner, she'd say, I hope to put you out of a job. Well, that just resonated amongst the Rust Belt. She was a flawed candidate that way, very intelligent, very capable person that just could not connect. And so Democrats were not excited about her. They weren't excited in Utah. With Obama, there was a joy to vote for Obama, the first African-American president, but there was a joy to it. There wasn't a joy to her voting for it. And I think that led to the lack of excitement amongst Democrats. It was mostly an anti-Trump vote. The second thing is, you look at this, I didn't realize this until after the election, when I started delving into this. The Republicans, everyone made fun of Trump for not having a ground game to get people to vote. He relied upon the Republican National Party. And this is why Reince Priebus has now all of a sudden become a hero. The get out the vote amongst Republicans, they actually had more field offices than the Democrats did. So under Mr. Priebus, he actually did a better job than the Democrats did in getting out the vote. And so you have a lower Democratic turnout and at least keeping the Republicans the same or a little bit higher. Obviously, that made for a victory. So with those two combination factors, that's the result we have on Tuesday night.
But also, Frank, you've got to also add into that, when Bill Clinton ran and was elected in 92, as really, he didn't get a majority of the vote. Of course, it was a three-way race. But he was the ultimate outsider. He spoke to people. People felt that he related to them. And I think, you know, the problem is Hillary ran, you know, as the inside candidate. Trump was the outsider, and people just didn't feel like, you know, that they related to her.
Well, can we ask, so I have two parts to this. One is because everything we just described there kind of seems to indicate that both sides had a candidate problem and not a party problem. Is that what this was?
Well, look, I mean, you know, people talk about what happened, but really, there was not really a race within the Democratic Party. I mean, you know, you had, you know, O'Malley. You know, I mean, here's Bernie Sanders, who wasn't even a Democrat until, you know, 2 years ago. I mean, every elected office that he'd ever run for had run as an independent. I mean, the problem is they didn't develop a bench. Then you had Obama, who basically talked Biden out of running. I mean, this thing, it wasn't like you had this, you know, this contest. And I don't think anybody anticipated, you know, the Sanders phenomenon. I mean, but what it was is people wanted someone else. So really, I mean, yeah. I mean, Donald Trump may have been my 19th choice out of 18 Republicans running, but at least you had a robust discussion about what was going to happen.
Explain. So here's a contradiction I've been wondering about as I'm seeing the numbers come out. So as of the day of the election, President Obama had a 56% approval rating.
Did he? I mean, no offense to Dan.
Okay.
I agree.
All poll suspect.
But dude, you have to ask the question. Did he have that high of an approval rating?
Okay. For the sake of this question, let's say that the polls are right about that.
But he did.
Who knows? I'm with Dan. Okay.
But they repudiated him.
So that's the question. So that is exactly the question. So you have someone who's at the end of his term, even higher than Ronald Reagan, with that 56%, if that's what it was. Yet the election itself seems to be a repudiation, as you said, of the status quo and the establishment, right? Explain this contradiction.
Again, no offense to pollsters, but I walked in Tuesday night thinking...
You're not a pollster, though. What was the name?
Cephologist.
So he's okay now.
There's no way Hillary could lose because there's such a high approval rating. I'm doubting if there's such a high approval rating because... all the issues with Obamacare and things like that. I'm just wondering if that is a true figure, if it's not closer to 50%, which is a big deal.
It would be a big deal.
I mean, well, it's interesting. I mean, look, President Obama, to his credit, Michelle Obama, I mean, they basically figured out that to continue their legacy, they needed Hillary to win. And they went all in. Mm-hmm. And so, in some ways, even though Hillary was a flawed candidate, you had the most popular person, you know, the person who people rallied around, and for some reason they weren't able to incite the base or those who, you know, that 5 or 6 million in the swing counties who went for them 4 years ago and 8 years ago. And I don't know, but it seems to me that there has to be some connection to some dissatisfaction with what is going on either in the economy or whether it's, you know, health insurance premiums or whatever the case may be. I don't know.
The other thing I want to say about approval ratings, let's assume that they got it right and it was a 56% correct. What I've noticed about approval ratings, and this happens in Utah and across the country, Americans are very good at compartmentalizing. Let's take, for example, Utah. When Jim Matheson was thinking about running for governor, and he had a high approval rate across the state, and he and I had that discussion, I said, the problem is this. You have a high approval rate. You've got a 60-some percent approval rating.
Highest of any elected official at the time.
Right. I said, they will tell you right before they go to the voting booth, they really like you, Jim Matheson. They're going to walk in, they're going to vote for whoever the Republican is, and walk back out and say, they really like you, Jim Matheson. Americans are very good at compartmentalizing. And I think that if he did have a high percentage approval rate, they said, yeah, we like President Obama, and we want to change. And that is typical American. They will make those two different compartmentalizations.
So is this part of the Catholic theology here, Frank, or is it does it spread beyond that?
Doug, we've been around for 2,000 years. Don't diss us.
Okay. All right. What do you think, Dan?
What I really found was that not only did Hillary Clinton and Mr. Obama, and Mr. Obama. He really did have the best approval rating that he's had. Look how much he overcome of being black or African American. But he was to get out the black vote, and the black vote didn't turn out. Some who did turn out voted for Trump. And the Hispanics didn't really turn out the way that they thought. And remember Mr. Kane went and spoke to him and gave a talk in Spanish? And they couldn't even win Arizona yet. It's not finally in. And so they tried on the minorities, and the minorities didn't really, really come in. It was the white male who did not have college degrees that really came. What we used to call when we pulled Joe Sixpack. We'd come home and open a pack of beer and watch television and didn't do anything with education. They're the ones that turned out and voted for Mr. Trump. See, what I really had a hard time with was with age, because you can't get a hold of the young people to find out if they're going to vote. But those over age 65 really wanted to vote, and they voted for Trump. They did, over age 65. And so the young people could have carried this for Hillary, but they didn't. And so I see all the protests going on, and I saw one in Westminster as I drove here. And they're all over. They're not going to take out Mr. Trump, but they have a right to protest.
But look, 8 years ago, when Barack Obama was elected president, he had almost 60 members of the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. He had an overwhelming majority of Congress. He lost it 2 years later. Hasn't come back. It's only gotten worse. I mean, this time the Republicans had to defend 24 seats. I mean, that's an awfully lot of seats to defend. You know, they basically kept, after Louisiana comes in, they will have kept 22 of those. So, I mean, they will have a majority. You have more Republican governors right now than you've ever had in the states. You've had more, you have more legislative bodies in the country that are controlled by Republicans in history. So what I'm saying is, I think people may like Barack Obama. I think they may have a respect for Barack Obama, but that doesn't mean they've bought into what he did or did not do. And I think there was this dissatisfaction with a lot of his policies that translated into the election.
Hmm. Let me ask you this, looking back historically, because at least one reason people have been speculating is that these things are just cyclical anyway. All right, you have to go back to George H.W. Bush, right? 28 years before a party has kept a third term. Is there anything to this argument that, hey, apart from all of these things, it was just, the pendulum was just going to swing? Is there anything to that?
I think there was some, but it didn't really apply in Utah. You see, look how long the Republicans have had the governorship.
1984.
So, now in Utah, the Republican Party is about 49%. The Democrats on a good day have 17%. But there are many, many more unaffiliates, sometimes called independents. Now, can a candidate in Utah win as an independent? You might find out in 2018 for Mr. Hatch's seat.
Whoa, you're just throw out that. You're just going to throw that out there?
Oh, I love the red meat on the water.
Well, the sharks will get it. But I want you to know that Senator Pat Jones has spent all the time going around to get young women to run for office, both Democrat and Republican. What did this election do to young women who had a hope that the glass ceiling was going to be broken? Who's going to break it? I didn't think I'd live to see an African American become president, but I did. I didn't think I'd live to see a woman become president, and she didn't.
So Dan,
was it because she was a woman that she lost, not the party? Why do people of Utah hate Hillary Clinton so much? Explain it to me. I really want to know. I'm not here to entertain you. I'm here to find out what the heck happened.
See, he's always asking the questions. Can we get to that in just a second? You had a comment on that?
Well, let me ask a question. I mean, look, any race, any political race, it's basically, you know, a competition between two individuals. And you have to make a choice. And, you know, you had two very, very, very flawed candidates, probably the two most flawed candidates, you know, in any of our lifetime. But the real question is if you had taken Hillary Clinton out of the mix and all of a sudden it was Elizabeth Warren or somebody of that nature, what would have happened? What would have happened if all of a sudden, you know, 4 years ago, if the Republicans had nominated Condoleezza Rice instead of Mitt Romney? Mm-hmm. I mean, Dan, you're asking a really, really, really good question, but and I don't know if you'll ever really know. And in some ways, it's like the Bradley effect, the mayor, the Mayor Bradley effect in California with Tom Bradley. You know, are there just some people that will not vote for a woman? I don't know, but I don't. And this is just a personal opinion. I think if the Democrats had nominated somebody like an Elizabeth Warren, I think they would have elected a president. But I don't know that. But it would be really interesting to see.
Any follow-up?
Well, they'll probably be asking that question now, the pollsters, but that didn't seem to show up on anything, and the gender. It was more of she just could not connect. And you asked about what happened to Utah, Dan. I mean, but there's always been an animosity in Utah towards the Clintons, whether it's Bill.
I mean, he took third.
So I think it's more just that this didn't like the family. But I look back at this, like the animosity towards Barack Obama. I mean, I can understand I disagree with policies, but this hatred. That he's like, look, you can say what you want about Barack Obama, but he's a good, decent person. He's a good family person. And he cares about his wife and kids, and he's decent to others. And he's essentially led a scandal-free administration. You can argue about all the executive orders, all the legitimate arguments, but there's this hatred towards him. And I don't know if it's racial-based or just because he's a liberal Democrat. The same thing happened to George W. Bush. I mean, there's this an animosity that somehow that they're less than human. And that's a bigger discussion that we need to have.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're broadcasting a discussion hosted recently by the Hinckley Institute of Politics about who won the election and why. The discussion included Dan Jones, the president of Dan Jones & Associates, the professional polling agency, also Doug Foxley, a lobbyist at the Utah State Legislature, Frank Pignanelli, also a lobbyist, a political columnist for the Deseret News, and a former Utah State Legislator. And the discussion was moderated by Jason Perry, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics.
Before we go and do some questions, let me ask, because when we talk about people showing up and we get to representation itself, so many, particularly the youth that I've been talking to recently, are wondering if there's still justification for the Electoral College, if someone does win the popular vote and not. And many people were not here when we start looking at the tyranny of the majority, which is designed to protect against. Can anyone make the case for it still? Either one of you want to do that, any of the three of you?
Well, it depends on whether you're Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. But look, we go back to the founding of the country. And in some ways, Alexander Hamilton, if you go back and read the Federalist Papers, I mean, he predicted that the weight of the presidency would change individuals. And I submit the weight of the presidency will change Donald Trump and his behavior. May be wrong, but I don't think so. But what happened is there was a decision that was made at that time that basically that, we've got a 2-3% margin of error, but we would rather vest the right in the states and have the states decide instead of the individuals. So it's inherent. Look, there's always been the discussion about the Electoral College and whether it's antiquated and this or that and the other. But, you know, it's worked to both parties' benefits through the years. Mm-hmm. And this time around, it didn't work for the Clintons. But on the other hand, I just don't see, it is so hard to amend the United States Constitution. I don't see anything happening. And is it perfect? No. But on the other hand, you know, like Dan taught me very well, you sometimes have the tyranny of the majority, and who knows? I mean, if I live in the state of Utah, I like the Electoral College, because it gives me more influence. If I live in California or Massachusetts or Texas or somewhere else, you know, I probably don't like it as much. Hmm. New York, I don't know.
And Frank, fire away.
When you look back at the documents, the Founding Fathers, what they wanted with the Electoral College was the group of people getting together and deciding the best person for the job out of those who've been running. That hasn't happened in over 150 years. I keep on hearing that's great for small states. I ask for proof of that. I never get proof of that. The one thing that happened in 2016 is that when we became a swing state, think of all the attention we got. Both camps came in here to try to get our vote. I'm a strong believer. Now, Doug's right. It's not going to happen through a constitutional amendment. But I believe that the Electoral College is a disservice to small states because we don't get paid attention to unless you're a swing state. In some of these places, like in Pennsylvania, they focus on one county because that switches where the results are not. Now, there is a movement, because it's so hard to change the Constitution, there is a movement to have the state legislatures agree to bind, but based upon popular vote and things like that, about where it goes. And there's some discussion about how you deal with the Electoral College. But in my opinion, it is outdated, and it's not reflective, and it's actually harder on the small states. The states that are truly swing states are the ones that benefit not only just by the attention from candidates, but also benefit from things that happen in Congress and the passage of legislation, like corn subsidies and things like that.
I do not believe that you're going to get the Electoral College taken away. You're going to keep it. See, did you know electors are not bound? They're going to meet on December 19th, isn't it?
State Capitol.
Yeah.
And vote the electors. Now, they go to their Secretary of State's office or our Lieutenant Governor's office, and we have 6 electors, but they're not bound. And several elections ago, people in Washington refused to vote for a presidential candidate because they stand on racial events. So now Alabama tried to bind them by law. Supreme Court says you can't. So we got to get Supreme Court back in business. We do. I don't know if we should appoint Orrin Hatch to Supreme Court, but we got to get somebody on there pretty darn soon and get some of these things resolved. But I think to change the Electoral College, you're going to need a constitutional amendment. There are 27 amendments now. It would become number 28. I don't see it happening.
All right, ready for some questions? Let's hear it. Got a few right here already, Max.
Yeah.
I'll speak loud.
Well, we want everyone to hear. Again, so we're recording this, so let's do it.
Okay. I'm Noel DeNevers. I'm an emeritus professor. The press is full of this being a change election, and yet I think one or two senators or one or two congressmen lost their jobs. So it may have been a change election for president, but why wasn't it a change election for Congress?
Want to add? Who wants to take the first shot at that?
Well, first of all, I think Republicans in the U.S. Senate had a strategy that they were going to distance themselves from Trump, and that they were going to be the entity which was going to protect the country from Hillary Clinton. I think they did a pretty good job of that. I think that basically through, you know, as Dan would say, gerrymandering or redistricting, no one ever thought the Congress was going to change hands. I mean, there were some people that thought they may lose 15 to 20 seats. In reality, they may lose 5 or 6. I mean, it's a small number. But really, this was not a mandate election, Doctor, because what happened is, you look at Trump. Trump really didn't enunciate an ideology. I mean, he pretty much has an open field when he takes over as president. It wasn't like he laid out a set of governing principles and this is what I'm going to do. So, I mean, I don't think there was a strong mandate, and I don't think Hillary Clinton really laid out a clear vision, of what she was going to do.
Do you think that as we were getting into this, as you had some members of Congress kind of jumping off the Trump ship, some of them did, some of them didn't, would you have expected that Donald Trump, maybe I'm assuming this is the answer, even had coattails to bring to this? Did he? Since he surged in so many places, did he help some of these people in the Senate and the House?
Well, do you think if Donald Trump wouldn't have done as well as he did in Pennsylvania, that Toomey would have won? I mean, take a look at Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody had declared, Ron Johnson dead, politically mm-hmm. dead. Guess what? He came back and beat Russ Feingold, away.
Right.
So I think in some states, not Utah, but I think some states, in particular the Upper Midwest, the Rust Belt, I think he did have coattails.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. All right, who's next?
Hi, my name is Nicholas Coleman, and I'm a student at the university. My question is, prior to the election, there was a lot of discourse about the Republican Party being shattered by Donald Trump, the whole movement. Calling for reform, a reform of the ideology, yet he won. So now there's a lot of discussion about whether or not the election results and whether or not the lack of turnout was actually just the Republicans being lucky. In your guys' opinion, do you believe that the Republican Party will need to go through a reformation of ideology, shifting around new leaders?
Well, I think everybody anticipated that that Donald Trump was going to lose, and all of a sudden, Rance Priebus was going to be driven out of town and tarred and feather, and people were ready for basically the meltdown. Guess what? They won. So all of a sudden, guess what? You're putting on, you're putting lipstick on a pig, so to speak, and all of a sudden, Paul Ryan and Donald Trump are trying to paper over things and this, that, and the other. The real battle is not going to be within the Republican Party, because people are going to hold their nose and rally around it. The real battle is going to happen in the Democratic Party. Because, whether you like it or not, you've got Donald Trump for 8 years.
It was interesting. A lot of my Republican friends talked about, can the Republican Party survive? And I would, Doug had made a statement earlier, which is true, is a majority of the governorships, a majority of the state legislatures are Republican hands. How can you say that the Republican Party is not going to survive? The Republican Party was in the middle of a civil war. They were fighting about ideology. I would disagree with Doug. There's a battle. There's going to be a battle of the Democratic Party. There's never been a battle. There was a purge. There was no civil war in the Democratic Party. Anyone that was left, anyone that was centrist Democrat has been shot down and killed. There was not a civil war. Elizabeth Warren and then the others, they just decimated moderate, business-friendly Democrats. When I was serving the legislature, I was involved in an organization called the Democratic Leadership Council.
With Bill Clinton.
It was part of the Bill Clinton. We were part of the Bill Clinton Brigade. We got Bill Clinton elected. We believed in free trade, things like that. They don't exist. You don't see any more Blue Dog Democrats. There was no civil war. They just purged them. And so what's going to be interesting is what the Democrats do on a national level, because they don't have this ideological battle going on. There is no Democrat equivalent of Paul Ryan turning out all these ideas. They've got to figure out how they're going to deal with it, because in many ways, this was a rejection of a lot of progressive things. You can talk about the Bernie Sanders movement and that, but remember, Bernie Sanders announces he's not even Democrat, and he gets all that support. That tells you where the ideology of the Democratic Party is, and there's a litmus test if you want to survive. And the Democrats got to figure out, is that a path to success, or is that they're just going to keep on fighting those battles? It may be, but there is no civil war. That's where you are as a Democrat.
Okay, what I found in Utah, the top three issues, number one is immigration. And there are young kids that won't go to school in Salt Lake right now because they're afraid of what's going to happen. Number two was Obamacare, health care. The people want help on health care, but what are you going to replace Obamacare with? And the third was ISIS. And what are we going to do about what's going over there in that section of the world? And there was more of an issue election than people realized. Now also, the Republican Party in Utah is in shambles. You wait. There's going to be a real, real struggle for power of the Republican Party in Utah.
But Dan, I agree, and if we were in the same traditional world that we'd lived in the past, it would have mattered. But I submit the Senate Bill 54, Count My Vote, changed the world. And all of a sudden, you take Nevada, it doesn't have a functioning Republican Party. Governor Sandoval, everybody has basically distanced themselves from it. If the Republican Party doesn't get its act together soon, it will be totally disregarded. Everybody will go the petition route to get on the ballot, and the Republican Party will become irrelevant.
The parties, the party structure, but people identify
the label. The label.
I still want the label. Democrats would love to have the shambles they described.
That they're describing right now. Well, there are issues in supermajorities also, as we found on the side of the state of Utah, which is what Dan's hinting at even now.
But you know, right? but to me, the real question, I thought somebody would ask it, but you know, who are the big winners and who are the big losers? I mean, in Utah, Greg Hughes was a big winner. Mm. I mean, he went out on the line for Trump and he stayed there. Don Pay went out on the line and stayed there. I mean, Mike Noel went out on the line, stayed there. Don Pay thinks he's going to be Secretary of the Interior. He isn't going to be, but, probably be Governor Butch Otter or somebody like that. Noel wants to be head of the BLM. You know, I mean, it's going to be interesting, but really, who were the losers in this election? Obviously, the Clintons, the Obamas, the Bushes. In Utah, you know, the guy that I feel badly for is Jason Chaffetz. I mean, Jason Chaffetz had 4 years of beating up on Hillary Clinton. Guess what? Now he's got the presidency. He can't do it. I mean, you know. So I mean, I'm telling you, it's fascinating. What really, you know, the winners and losers. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I look at John Huntsman Jr. I mean, he was an outsider. Donald Trump was an outsider. They had the Wharton connection, then all of a sudden he distanced himself. But Donald Trump has got to make entreaties to a whole bunch of people who said they were against him to bring them back into the fold. I think the dynamics of what is going to play out in the inner politics and workings are really big. I think Mitt Romney was a big, big loser in this campaign. I mean, I think he was severely damaged. And anyway, it'll be interesting to see.
I may be breaking confidence, but I met with a gentleman who I grew up with picking spuds, and his son, John Huntsman Jr., I served with as his pollster. John Huntsman predicted to me on December 16th, 2015, that Mr. Trump would be elected president. I didn't take it seriously. I do now. He won. And I wish Mr. Trump good luck. And hopefully can bring America together. I get tired of being hung up on the phone by saying that all politics and government is corrupt and evil. Young people, get involved. I'd like to take a personal moment. How proud I am of Jason Perry and what he's doing with the Hinckley Institute. I'm very proud of Dr. Foxley. Yeah, Dr. Foxley, a former student of mine at Utah State, was given an honorary degree at Utah State. And what a wonderful job that Frank Piccinelli does every Sunday in the Desert News and gives his column out, but also is outstanding in influencing the legislature. You know what the legislators told me about him? He has never lied to us. He tells it the way it is. So what an honor it has been here. I thank Jane Nelson for all that she has done. And I hope that America does recover from this election, and that we go on, and that we do the things that are right, not only for the American people, but for the world. And I appreciate the opportunity that I have of being here.
Wow. And we have to say something great about Dan Jones. Can you believe we even get to sit here with him to listen to all of this?
The legend.
The legend. He called me like 2 a.m., I think, you know, still awake, watching the polls come in.
So Dan dealt with Mr. Robert Hinckley. Uh-huh. And Mr. Hinckley had a vision. And his vision was, it was you, that we have to basically train the next generation to lead. And many of you are here. Many of you think you want to run campaigns, this and that and the other. The one thing that I think Dan will tell you, and Mr. Hinckley would have told you, is prepare yourself to run, prepare yourself to serve. In order to have good government, you know, yeah, we all look at, you know, governor's races and Senate races and congressional races, but we need good people. School boards, city councils, on and on and on. So prepare yourself to run.
How many in here plan on running?
Excellent. Good. Excellent. I think that's one of the great takeaways from this. As you see people, even some of the protesters out there, that's just as American as voting too, is the right to peacefully gather and have your opinion. I think what's just the important part of this is that every one of you, particularly the ones that want to be running for something, you follow this closely and you stay engaged. Happened to both the speeches, from the concession speech and the victory speech, was stay engaged. We heard from both of those.
And by the way, I kudos to Hillary Clinton on a phenomenal concession speech. She was magnanimous, and I think we saw in Donald Trump a victory speech that nobody anticipated, and hopefully, I mean, she said, you know, give him a chance, and let's see what happens.
That's good. Let's give a round of applause for these great panelists. We're thrilled to have you here.
Thanks for tuning in today and for the discussion about the results of the 2016 election, who won, and why. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.